Welcome back to the podcast. I know it's been a couple months since part one of the history of American securities regulation was released. I did record part two with Eric, so that will be released over the next couple weeks. Just wanted to hope everyone's doing well. Glad to be back on the regularly scheduled program after the holidays with a weekly Law of Code episode. Now to the podcast. Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
All right, everyone. After a couple minutes of technical difficulties, I'm here and joined by Elliot Z. Stein. Elliot is a senior litigation analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, and he previously spent years in private practice working on structured finance and capital markets litigation, white-collar crime, and related capital markets matters. We're going to touch on the Coinbase hearing. We'll talk a bit about the Ripple decision, and then we'll talk about his work at Bloomberg. Elliot, thank you for joining me today.
Jacob, thank you so much for having me. I've been a longtime fan of your podcast, so it's truly an honor to be on an episode.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to hear that someone like yourself is listening, so thank you. Let's talk about the Coinbase hearing. So last June, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, sued Coinbase, alleging that they are operating as a broker, exchange, and clearing agency rolled into one for certain securities. And then they also mentioned things like staking. And so there's the broker claims, the primary claims regarding the trading, and then there's these staking claims. You attended the Coinbase hearing live. Could you describe the courtroom on January 17th?
Yeah. So like you said, this is really a fascinating time in terms of litigation related to digital assets. And this SEC versus Coinbase case is certainly one of the most interesting that falls under that umbrella. So the hearing was on Coinbase's motion for judgment on the pleadings, essentially Coinbase's early bid to try to get the case dismissed before fact discovery. The hearing was held in Lower Manhattan in the Southern District of New York, federal court downtown. The judge was Judge Fela, who is a terrific judge, just super smart, extremely sharp. I like to say she has a sense of humor drier than the Sahara, and I mean that in the most positive way. She has a terrific sense of humor, but it's extremely, extremely dry, and if you don't get that, you might miss it. But yeah, it was a hearing. So on one side of the gallery in the front row was the Coinbase legal team, Paul Graywall, the chief legal officer at Coinbase. I believe it was his deputy next to him, and then a few other folks who I didn't recognize. On the other side of the gallery was the SEC, including Antonia Apps, who's the head of the SEC's New York regional office, and presumably other members of her enforcement team. And then plenty of other people in the gallery watching. Some, I believe, were media and reporters. And then at counsel table, the front table was the SEC because they're the plaintiffs in this case. They had, I believe, three lawyers there. And then the table behind them was Coinbase. And you had William Savitt, who led the argument for Coinbase. He's a lawyer at Wachtell Lipton, top firm. And he had a couple other people from his firm. And then also Stephen Pekin from Sullivan and Cromwell, who was also, under the Trump administration, one of the co-directors of the SEC's enforcement division. Wow. And so, yeah, some heavy, heavy hitters. And the argument, as you would expect from great lawyers, was just top notch. And usually hearings like this, the moving party will sort of make their case and the judge will pepper them with questions. And then the other side will make their arguments and the judge will pepper them with questions. That's not how this hearing went. Judge Fela jumped right in with questions. It turns out she had 14 pages of questions, and every single question was a good one and was trying to figure out where the weaknesses were in that side's argument. And she started with questions for the SEC. That took about 2 hours. And then after that, she had questions for Coinbase, and that took about 2 hours. So it wound up being over a 4-hour hearing, and it was just fascinating from start to finish.
And was it true no one was given a lunch break?
No one was given a lunch break. I believe she asked the lawyers after the 2 hour mark if they wanted a lunch break. And I think they came back and said no. So we went straight through with maybe a 10 or 15 minute break in the middle.
Right. And hearing like this, I heard there were some 300 plus people listening in online. Did that affect the hearing at all?
No, it was as is often common right before the hearing, as people were getting on the phone, a million people weren't muted. So there were a few stern warnings, I guess, from the judge's courtroom clerk to put yourself on mute. And then I think from there, they just put everyone in listen only mode. So it wasn't an issue. But I've been on, especially during COVID, when all hearings were virtual, there have been times where it's sort of a disaster because everyone's dialing in and it's just very disruptive. But this was fine. It wasn't an issue at all.
I can imagine you have quite a few stories of hearings and cases gone awry. And so in your 2024 Outlook video, I'll link that in the show notes below.
Cool, thanks.
In that you mentioned you liked Coinbase's chances, right, in the litigation, given the strength of their primary argument against the classification of tokens as securities. And that was largely helped by the Ripple decision we had earlier last year. You went into this hearing, though, thinking that Coinbase would win dismissal on the Securities and Exchange Commission's primary claims, so those regarding trading, but maybe not on the staking and broker claims. And this was all pre-hearing. Why did your perspective, or how did your perspective change following the hearing on January 17th?
So going into the hearing, as you said, I did think Coinbase was going to win dismissal of the SEC's main claims having to do with trading on the platform. But I thought they probably might not win dismissal at this stage. Remember, we're at a very early stage in the litigation of the staking claims and maybe the wallet / broker claims. Coming out of the hearing, thought Coinbase did even better than I anticipated going in. And I left the hearing thinking that they're going to win dismissal on all three of those claims. And again, this is a motion for judgment on the pleadings. It's a very early bid by Coinbase to try to get the case knocked out before discovery. The legal standard for that motion really favors the plaintiff generally, right? The SEC in this case, because the judge has to accept all the SEC's allegations as true and then decide as a matter of law, if I accept all those facts as true, can I dismiss this case just as a matter of law? The way the law was developing, and even before the Ripple case, a lot of lawyers in the crypto community were making what I thought was a very good point, which was that you have to distinguish between the digital assets themselves and how they're transacted when you apply the Howey test. And I think most of your listeners know by this point, the Howey test is from the Supreme Court case in 1946 about how to interpret the term investment contract under the securities laws. And the main issue in a lot of these cases is whether digital assets constitute investment contracts and therefore are securities that the SEC can regulate. Where the law was going, even before the Ripple case, I think, was that you have to distinguish between the digital asset itself and how it's transacted. And just because a digital asset is a security or an investment contract in one transaction doesn't mean that it's also going to be an investment contract in a separate transaction. And the Ripple case really made that clear, because the judge there, Judge Torres, said, well, okay, when XRP is sold directly to purchasers, that in that case, she thought that it constituted an investment contract. But when XRP was sold on public exchanges and programmatic sales, she said, no, that doesn't meet the elements of the Howey test, because purchasers don't know who's on the other side. And so you don't have that meeting of the minds that would satisfy the contract element of the term investment contract. And so when the Ripple decision came out, I thought, wow, this is going to be great for Coinbase. I'm not the only one who thought that, obviously, because it really did signify that there's a distinction between sales directly from issuers to purchasers versus sales on public exchanges. And in the Coinbase case, we're really talking about secondary market sales, which are akin to the public exchange sales in Ripple. And so that's why I thought going in that Coinbase was going to have a really strong argument on those claims. But I thought maybe the staking claims and the wallet claims might have more factual disputes that the judge wouldn't be able to decide as a matter of law at this stage, and she would have to let it go to discovery. And I thought Coinbase would still have good arguments down the road. But in the hearing, I thought Coinbase made really compelling arguments. I expected them on the trading claims, and they did make great arguments on the trading claims. So that's why I didn't change my view there. But on staking and on the wallet claims, I thought they took the standard on head on. They took the motion for judgment on the pleading standard on. They took it head on and said, look, the way the SEC has drafted this complaint, they haven't, even though all they have to do is lay out enough allegations to make out a plausible claim, Coinbase said they haven't even met that. On the staking claims, they said there's no actual investment here. Even if you accept their pleadings as true, those pleadings are undercut by the Coinbase user agreement, which the judge can take judicial notice of. And because there's no transfer of ownership from Coinbase users when they stake their assets, there's no risk of loss. And therefore, it doesn't meet what the term investment should mean under the Howey test and under the term investment contract. And similarly, with the wallet claims, they said with the wallet claims, that's just a fee for a service. There's no allegation in the complaint that Coinbase is really acting as a broker. The only allegation that would suggest that they're acting as a broker is that they were making fees off of commissions, that they were making commissions from trades, but that they weren't really doing the traditional things that a broker does. There's no allegations in the complaint that they were soliciting orders, that they were recommending certain trades, that they were routing orders. All the things that would suggest traditional broker conduct, that's not in the complaint. And as a result, they haven't made out a sufficient claim, even that they haven't pleaded enough to even make out a plausible claim when you look at the complaint. And so that's why I left the hearing. Coinbase obviously made the argument a lot better than I just did, but I left that hearing thinking, wow, I think they may have convinced the judge that the complaint is insufficient in every respect.
Thank you, Elliot. And I think that explanation is so helpful for those who weren't following along as well to see the different prongs of Coinbase's argument and the different points that they made concerning things like staking and why your perspective would have changed following the hearing. Judge Fela told the attorneys that she was concerned that the agency was asking her to, quote, broaden the definition of what constitutes a security. Could you describe what that back and forth looked like?
Yeah, Judge Fela was asking the SEC, okay, so under your theory, what is the investment here and what is the contract, right? And the SEC's answer is, well, in a direct sale, you have an investment of money in the common enterprise because the purchaser gives their money to the issuer and they get a digital asset in return. Here, you don't have that on the secondary market. And so the SEC was left to argue that the investment in a common enterprise is really an investment in the ecosystem, in the network around the digital or whatever digital asset the purchaser is buying, and that the contract is really the reasonable expectation of profits under the Howey test, which is interpreting the term contract under the securities laws. That is the promotional and marketing materials from the issuer that say, yeah, we're going to work to increase the value of the network, and that'll increase the value of your tokens. And Judge Fela said, well, if that's your standard for what an investment contract is or how the Howey test should be applied, that's going to rope in a lot of things, including collectibles like Beanie Babies and baseball cards. And that was her concern. And I don't think the SEC had a satisfactory answer for what the limiting principle would be under their theory. They tried to argue that there's no ecosystem around Beanie Babies. They even, I think, tried to argue that there's no ecosystem around Bitcoin, which everyone agrees is not a security. But that wasn't satisfying to me. I don't think it was satisfying to the judge.
And I wasn't satisfying to me either. I think it's dangerous when you can stretch things. And we've seen on Twitter for years people talking about Pokemon cards or sports cards and really how you are dependent on the third party not to print a million of them, for example, even if you buy, let's just say, a Tom Brady autographed sports card, right? If Upper Deck or the Tops starts pumping out thousands of them, well, all of a sudden the value of your investment could decrease significantly.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And look, I collected baseball cards as a kid. A lot of people did, right? But if there's a whole ecosystem around it, and however many cards Topps releases is going to, it's simple supply and demand. It's going to affect the value of your cards.
And so you expected the decision, I think you said 70% confident in Coinbase. And I love to see that, because this was, hey, here's a definitive number. And I know that's a big part of what you do at Bloomberg, but I'd love to know how you determine a number, like why 70, why not 60%?
Yeah, so it's less mathematical than you're probably thinking. And so on our team, just so we have some standardization across all our analysts on the litigation and policy team here, we try not to make any 50-50 calls, because that's too wishy-washy. If it's a close case, but we're leaning to one side, then we use 60%. Okay. 70% is like if I have a solid base case, and then you go from there. 80s, I'm more confident than even your normal base case. And 90s, almost a foregone conclusion, it's going to go a certain way.
And what would be, like, when you think about that 30% that leads you to thinking, okay, is it just the fact that it's such a low bar for the Securities and Exchange Commission to meet that there is a plausible argument in some case?
Yeah, exactly. And in my mind, I think that the claim that is most likely to get dismissed are the trading claims, for the reasons we spoke about before. I think the wallet claims are also very weak in terms of how they've been pleaded, because, again, the SEC has not really alleged things that you would expect from a broker. And then the staking claims are probably the closest. And again, it's because it's an early stage, it's a low bar. There's probably some factual questions around whether Coinbase's conduct was ministerial versus managerial in terms of the staking service. So that's probably a factual question. But I think on the investment side, and whether there was a risk of loss, the judge spent a lot of time early in the hearing asking what documents she can take judicial notice of. Right? Like, what can she consider at this stage of the litigation? And one of the things that Coinbase says she can consider, or at least take judicial notice of, is their user agreement. And the user agreement, you know, contradicts the allegations that the SEC has made. So the SEC has to plead something plausible, but it can't be conclusory, and it can't be contradicted by other documents that the court can consider. Now, look, Judge Phelan may arrive at the conclusion that this is a factual question that needs to be decided after discovery. And so that's why there's that 30% possibility that she denies the motion in part and allows certain claims to go to discovery.
And so when you decided, or not decided, but even prior to this case, you had said you expected a decision in Q2 or Q3 of this year. Do you still think that's the case? And if so, how do you think about determining how much time is needed for a decision?
Yeah, so the 2Q, 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 3, Q3 was my estimate before the hearing. Coming out of the hearing, it was clear Judge Phelan is extremely efficient. That's always been clear if you've been in her courtroom. But it was really clear after this hearing that she has thought about this case a lot. She had 14 pages of questions. She may already even have part of the decision written, and she just needs to fill in gaps and decide exactly where she wants to go with things. So I put now end of second quarter as the outer limit, but I would not be surprised if it comes much sooner than that, possibly in February or sometime in the first quarter. And yeah, so sometimes, how do I arrive at the timing? I believe the past is always prologue. And if there are there are good comparables you can use from that judge with a similar type of decision and a similar type of issue. That's always, to me, the best indicator. I didn't have anything great to use here. Like, I looked at Uniswap because she decided that case, but there wasn't oral argument there, so that didn't really help. So I figured something like this, it's not going to go more than 5 months, right, which puts you at the end of Q2. And just given how efficient she is, it's probably going to be much sooner than that.
Right. And say the decision is a dismissal in favor of Coinbase. What do you expect to happen after that?
So a dismissal could come in two flavors, right? It could be a dismissal with prejudice, which means that the SEC is not allowed to amend its complaint, or it could be without prejudice, which would allow the SEC to amend their claims. And maybe she dismisses some with prejudice and some without. So we'll have to see how that plays out. And then if the claims are dismissed, I would expect the SEC to appeal the decision. And at the end of the day, the main issue, which digital asset transactions are securities, that to me is something that inevitably is going to get to the Supreme Court.
And there are many others who share that sentiment with you. It doesn't seem like one of those questions that the Supreme Court would let sit, especially given the makeup of the Supreme Court right now as well. There could be an interesting narrowing, and that's what I've seen a few people posit as a potential endgame here, a narrowing of Howie. What do you think that would look like? Is that something you've thought about at all?
Yeah, and what's interesting is the main cases we have right now are SEC Coinbase in federal court in New York. We have the Binance case, which is in federal court in Washington, D.C. We have the SEC versus Kraken case, which is in the Northern District of California. And one of the easiest ways to get to the Supreme Court, of course, is having a circuit split, that the federal appeals courts disagree about a particular issue. And so you have these three major SEC cases, again, that are most likely going to get up on appeal to three different circuit courts. And I'm sure there will be some variation in how these issues are decided. And that's going to then funnel these cases, or at least one of them, into the Supreme Court, most likely.
And then when it does head to the Supreme Court, do you expect a narrowing of Howie as well?
Yeah, I do. I just think given the textualist approach that the conservative justices in particular that they follow, I think they're going to look at the term investment contract, right? And they're going to say, well, the terms are pretty clear. Like, it needs to be some sort of a real investment, right? And they may look at some of the case law that preceded the securities laws from the 1930s. And they'll also look at the facts of Howie and its progeny. And Coinbase makes a great argument that all those cases had some sort of investment in a business enterprise or in its assets or in its capital structure. And then the term contract, right? It's right there in the statutes. Like it's contract. You need to have some sort of meeting of the minds. And again, that's something you had in Howie and cases that preceded it, and then in its progeny as well. And so based on that, I think they'll sort of refine Howie and put sort of a narrower spin on it and say, similar to what Coinbase is saying, that you need to have really an investment in the business enterprise, not just in the ecosystem. And you need to have a contract, some sort of enforceable agreement or enforceable obligation or promise. And that's how they'll narrow it.
And one thing I just want to touch on based on that, if we do get to the point where we see a narrowing of Howie and it's limited to areas or instances where there is both an investment and a contract, that would largely exclude secondary sales and exchange sales of digital assets. What could happen then is there could be a rulemaking by Congress. There could be rulemaking by an agency as well if they're delegated those powers, right? I wanted to ask you is how you've seen the role of Coinbase's petition for rulemaking to the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was denied, I believe, in December of last year. What factor has that played in the case?
In this case, it didn't come up in the argument. I don't think it's a factor for this motion. About what has sort of perplexed me, and I haven't gotten a satisfactory answer, is I do think there's actually maybe a little bit of an inconsistency in Coinbase's arguments, because on the one hand, in that petition for rulemaking, they're asking for the SEC to promulgate rules of the road for crypto, which implicitly suggests that they think the SEC has the statutory authority to do that. But in the SEC action against Coinbase, Coinbase's one of their arguments is the major questions doctrine, and they're essentially saying that the SEC doesn't have jurisdiction over crypto because Congress has not expressly given that power to the SEC. So to me, there is some tension between these two arguments in these two different cases, and no one has been able to reconcile those for me. So maybe one of your listeners will, I don't know.
There you go. If anyone's listening and wants to add to that, you can. I'll link Elliot's Twitter in the show notes. You can shoot him a DM.
Careful what I ask for him.
No, it's a really good point, right? And I think it's something that's overlooked. Where in one hand, if you're arguing that someone hasn't done the job they're supposed to do, but in this other hand, you're saying, oh, that's actually not their job. It can be really inconsistent.
Yeah. Although Coinbase has like the best lawyers on the planet, from their own chief legal officer to their outside counsel. So I'm sure I'm missing something, and I'm sure they have made the right arguments.
Yeah, and I'm sure they've thought it through too. I mean, even just to put yourself in their shoes, there is a benefit to say, hey, we asked for the rules. We tried to work with you. It's clear to us that you aren't the right regulator. Not only did you not make rules, but then you bring these suits that we think are baseless and you don't have jurisdiction over. So putting that aside, if we do see a narrowing of Howie, that would almost sound the alarm bells to, I think, a lot of Congress to say, okay, well,
yeah,
now digital assets are clearly outside the scope of the regulatory ambit we have today. We need to promulgate some rules. We actually need to set up something. Do you see that being as a net positive for the industry?
Yeah, I think that would be a good thing, right? I mean, it would be for Coinbase, it would be a good thing if they win dismissal of the case. And then for the industry overall, I think it would be very good if Congress is able to pass something that is clearer than what the industry has now about who has jurisdiction over what.
Yeah, it's interesting. My perspective is that it will be really painful in the short term, but exceptionally positive in the longer term. And by that, I mean, there are so many projects right now that if rules are promulgated, it might say, oh, we wanted rules, but not those ones. And we're not willing to comply. And who knows what that does with the markets and the valuation. So I think it could lead to some short-term pain, but long-term, I agree with you.
Yeah, likewise.
Yeah, it will be interesting. So let's just quickly talk about Ripple. Would love to hear your thoughts on that case. Just and I don't want to get into too many specifics, but just what your thoughts are and what'll happen next and where
we're at. So where they are now is, I mean, we already talked about Judge Torres's decision in July. By the way, that decision dropped during another hearing in the SEC versus Coinbase case. I was in court for a pre-motion conference on this motion in the SEC versus Coinbase case. I'm sitting right behind the SEC lawyers, and I have my phone in there, and I'm, you know, checking Twitter probably. And I see that the Ripple decision dropped during the Coinbase hearing. It was crazy. Well, yeah. And then you could see all the SEC lawyers like suddenly like scrolling through their phones. Like,
I was going to say they must not have been celebrating that one.
No, no. But yeah, so where that case is. So we had that decision in July. Following that decision, the only issue that she didn't decide on summary judgment was the individual claims. So those were going to go to trial after that summary judgment decision. But then the SEC dropped those claims a couple months after the July decision. So now where that case is that they are determining, or the parties are going to argue what the proper remedies should be for the transactions that Judge Torres determined were securities. And then that'll be decided later this year. And then from there, I expect both sides to appeal because both sides have reason to appeal, right? The SEC wants to appeal the public exchange transactions, which were not deemed to be securities. And Ripple is going to want to appeal the part of the decision that deemed the direct sales to be securities.
Yeah, it will be interesting. And even your point earlier about how many different cases we have going on in different courts in different areas of the country, it seems very inefficient, but I'm sure it'll take us to an interesting spot at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's just go back in time. I'd love to hear the story of your Genesis block. When were you first introduced to Bitcoin and what was your thought?
You know, it was, so I've been in this job since 2014, and I don't know, like I can't pinpoint the first time I heard about Bitcoin or digital assets. I suspect it was when I was in this job, probably in like the 2015 timeframe, but I didn't really start focusing on it until there was litigation around it, right? And like you started having some cases crop up in like, I want to say like 2016, 2017, around mostly like fraudulent activity, but in cases that were brought by the SEC or the CFTC, the threshold issue was, okay, are these transactions securities or are these assets commodities? And do these agencies even have jurisdiction to bring these cases? So that's how I sort of started getting more aware about the space. I didn't really start writing about anything though until the SEC sued Ripple at the end of 2020. And that's when I started digging in a little more. And then over the last 2 years, there's definitely been an onslaught of SEC cases, and I'm not covering them all. I'm primarily focused on public companies and how litigation can affect them. So that's why the Coinbase case is of most interest to me.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense given your role at Bloomberg as well, too. And speaking of your role now, I'd love to talk a bit about your career. And you went from a research assistant at Stanford University Medical Center to HR and recruiting at an internet startup in the late 90s, to today as an analyst at Bloomberg, a legal analyst. So you've had a really interesting career, and I can imagine gained so many skills along the way. But how did you find yourself in the legal profession?
So that first job you mentioned as a research assistant at the VA hospital in Palo Alto, I was a psychology major in college, so that was a natural first job out of college. And I thought I was going to go into like clinical psych or something like that. That job sort of dissuaded me from going down that route. And this is like the late 90s, right? So the tech boom is happening. I'm in Silicon Valley, so it was natural to go work at a startup. I didn't really have tech skills to be an engineer, so I wound up at a startup and I was doing HR and recruiting because I could. And then,
what was the startup? What area was the startup in? Did it have
any? So the startup was called OnDelay. And what they did was they automated online auctions for high volume sellers. So eBay was already around. So and people were making, like, doing good business selling things in volume on eBay. And so what OnDelay did was they sort of automated that whole business for these folks on the back end. Fast forward a couple of years and the bubble bursts and I'm like, okay, well, I always had law school in the back of my mind. As a kid, I thought maybe I'd like go be a sports agent or something like that. And at the time I had a couple of friends at the law firm Wilson Sonsini in Palo Alto, and they seemed to enjoy their work. So I went there as a paralegal. I applied to law school and then moved to New York for law school.
And you've been at Bloomberg for almost 10 years now, I believe. One thing I find that's interesting with the work people like yourself do is the balance between the deep work, which it takes, right, to come up with theses, to come up with articles, while balancing breaking news. And you have to almost monitor both at the same time. How do you strike that balance?
It's tough. And I think the most important thing is to be able to pivot quickly as needed and then return to whatever you were working on before. It's definitely a challenge. Like you're working on something, you're like deep in it, and then you see these red headlines on the terminal or something on the TV and you're like, this decision just dropped, right? And you have to turn to that. And then the challenge, of course, is like if what just happened is a 100-page decision, let's say, you have to like process that really quickly and try to get something that published something that is accurate, informative, and quick, even though it's a lengthy document that you have to review.
Yeah, I can imagine that's a difficult balance to always achieve. And even your example earlier about being at the Coinbase hearing and then having the Ripple decision drop, and now the internal debate over how much time do I spend on Twitter versus listening.
That's exactly right. And for that particular case, I remember I was in court, but I had to go home right after to tend to something. And so I'm on the train home, I'm reading the Ripple decision, I'm formulating in my head what I'm going to write. I get home, I do what I have to do quickly, and then I get online and I write my update.
Yeah, it's a very interesting career. What surprised you the most of the move to Bloomberg? Now, you were a private practice attorney, and then you went to move to Bloomberg. I'd love to know why you made that move, and was it what you expected?
Yeah, so the reason, when I graduated law school, I thought I would go to a law firm for like 3 years, get great experience, and then, you know, go in-house and do something that had sort of a better work-life balance. I wound up working at a law firm for 9 years, and I loved it. It was fascinating work, and that's why I lasted longer than the 3 years I originally thought I'd last. And sort of in the latter half of those 9 years, I was at the law firm Lowenstein Sandler, and I helped start their structured finance litigation blog. And I really enjoyed that. I've always been a news junkie, so it was a way to sort of pull back a little from all the really intense legal work and sort of think big picture about some of the cases that were important and writing about them. And so that made me think, maybe there's other things besides practicing law that might interest me. And at the same time, I happened to see the job, a posting for the job I'm in now. And it was an exciting time because Bloomberg Intelligence at the time was only a few years old, and they were just starting a litigation and policy team. And I was one of the first hires, and I was covering litigation in the financial sector. And there was so much at the time, litigation stemming from the financial crisis. And it was directly relevant to what I had been doing as a lawyer. And so it was a natural transition. And I've enjoyed every minute since. You asked what's the most surprising thing, just how much I like it. It's great to be able to follow so many important cases that are these crypto cases being a great example, where there are these unsettled issues of law that have huge ramifications, and I get to follow them, I get to write about them, people rely on me to update what's happening in these cases. So it's been a great ride.
Oh, and I can imagine when something like crypto comes onto your radar, it does add a really interesting twist to the legal arguments, the conversations around them, and I'm sure your work as well.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about this job is I'm writing for 300,000+ Bloomberg Terminal subscribers, and I interact with them, not all of them, obviously, but on a daily basis, and it's just really interesting conversations, great questions, and it's just intellectually stimulating every single day.
I can imagine. So two questions for you, Elliot, if you have time.
Yeah.
So the first is about 2024. And so we have the Coinbase case going on. There's Binance, there's Kraken, there's many others. Is there one that you think will be particularly important, or is there anything happening in the legal field that maybe people don't have an eye on in the crypto space that they should potentially consider? Those are both two very different questions, but feel free to answer whichever.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Coinbase case is probably the most important. I mean, Binance and Kraken are certainly, they're very similar in a lot of ways, but they have additional allegations. Binance has fraud claims, Kraken has commingling claims. Coinbase is really just a case about which digital asset transactions are securities, right? That's really the main issue. That issue is in the other cases too, but the Coinbase case is almost entirely about that. And they're basically the biggest player in the U.S. in that space. And so to me, it's the most important case right now.
Well, I'm glad we have you following it, and I'll definitely be bugging you to have you back on the podcast again to touch on it. Last question for you. I was looking through some of your tweets, and I noticed the Bloomberg Litigation and Policy Team has a podcast called Votes and Verdicts. I'll put a link in the show notes below for everyone to listen. So when you and Nathan host, you ask guests what music they'd want on a desert island, and I saw you were quite a big Bob Dylan fan, but rather than giving you an easy answer like that, I thought I'd turn it to sports. And I know you're a sports fan, so if you could only watch one sport on an island, what would it be and why?
Oh, man. So first of all, thank you for plugging our podcast. And I have to tell you that we end all our episodes with that question, what would you listen to? What kind of music would you want on a desert island? But we start most of our episodes asking how our guests got to where they are. And I was inspired to do that from your podcast because you always ask people what their Genesis block is. So I just want to let you know that. Yeah. What sport, if there was one sport I could watch? So first of all, as my wife and kids will tell you, if there's sports on TV, I'm always watching it, much to their chagrin. But if I had to choose one sport to watch, this would probably be too cheesy, but it would be my kids playing soccer or basketball. They play, I have three daughters, and they do a lot of soccer and a fair amount of basketball. And there's nothing better than watching your kids play sports.
That's really sweet. Yeah, I'll let you get away with picking multiple sports. Elliot. Well, thank you. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me and the kind words too. So thank you for that. And thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you, Jacob. Really appreciate it. Had a good time chatting.